Okay, we're going now to Marnie, who's going to talk about the cultural changes that came about, not only radio astronomy, but astronomy as a result of the large new facilities, expensive new facilities that were built during the 60s. Marnie.
Okay, thanks, Ken. Let's see. I think I can face this way, look at this thing, and we don't have the problem that we had at the opening ceremony. But this one is, we do have exact, oh no.
No, you don't, you're okay.
Okay, so quick overview. I'll introduce this through the discovery process itself, which is a topic I like to think about. And show you how a transition occurred between discoveries being made with specialized and general purpose instruments. That's what this talk is about. And I'll just flash through some of the discoveries, most of which will be talked about, some already, some later today, with general purpose telescopes. I will throw in the impact of huge technology changes that were happening in the 60s. And I'll finish up with a few words about the concept of not just general purpose telescopes, but user facilities, which were used not by the people who built them, but by astronomers in the community at large. So this is well known at the inception of a new field, like the discovery of radio emission. Discoveries are going to be made with rather simple instruments because you've opened up suddenly a whole lot of parameter space which hasn't been explored before. So if you're looking, we know this, in the universe, in some new parameter space, then you're very likely to find things. And that dominated the first decades of radio astronomy. Quite interesting quote which Jessica brought to my attention as she's preparing for a talk she's giving tomorrow, I think, Jessica? From Richard Woolley, who during the 60s was the Astronomer Royal. And the radio astronomers were doing so brilliantly well, but he made the point that the radio people were unreasonably lucky. Sometimes I think are rather arrogant. Because we have half of all the Nobel Prizes, we think we're really clever because we're radio astronomers, but we are damn lucky to be radio astronomers because that opened all this new parameter space, not because radio people were cleverer than optical people. So I thought that was interesting. Thank you, Jessica. But after the new field is starting to mature, there is a transition. I'll show you the evidence for that in a minute. In which the discoveries stop being made by the specialized equipment and start to require more sophisticated equipment, more collecting area. And that was the period of the 1960s where we did this transition from special purpose to general purpose. Here's a plot which you may have seen before. It's taken from the paper by Wilkinson, Kellerman, myself, Jim Gordius, Joe Lazio, on the discovery, the unexpected discoveries in radio astronomy. So these lists, this is a list of key discoveries, SKA Weld, you might think of key science drivers. These were key discoveries, and all of us five authors actually had to agree when we voted, and so this list has got some That's why we have this particular list. There's some things on it, some things are not, but everybody agreed to this particular subset. You will notice that the period of the 60s has got half of the entries in this list, and that's why we're having this meeting today. Now, taking this very same list, plotting it against time, and asking the question, were the discoveries made with specialized instruments, or were they made with general purpose instruments, you get this plot. And you see, before 1960, almost everything was being discovered with specialized equipment. And then during the 60s, we actually have a majority of things being discovered with general purpose equipment. So there is, and from then on, it's almost always been with general purpose facilities. So this 1960s was in fact this cultural change, going from individuals, clever individuals, building some piece of equipment that could do something new, to the beginning of radio observatories, in which much more resources would be put into the equipment. In particular, a look at the telescopes that were built and opened during this period. It's also, I surprised myself when I put this list together, and it's not complete, but it's all the biggest telescopes, and a lot of things were happening. OVRO started just before this period, but did much of its work in the 60s. The Parkes radio telescope was opened early in the 60s. Cambridge One Mile Telescope, Arecibo. I will give you examples of the discoveries from each of these as I go through. Haystack and Greenbank. When I made the table, I always assumed Haystack followed Greenbank, but according to history, that wasn't the case. Interesting. So Greenbank took forever to build for some reason. I was being cynical. Also, I thought noticeable the ELA proposal was submitted in this period, and I'll conclude with some remarks on that, sneaking it in through that route, solar heliograph. And all through the 60s, the Westerbork synthesis telescope was being built in Oakland until 1970, so I can't sneak that in anymore. I could have illustrated this change from specialized to general purpose many ways. I happen to have easily available some of the telescopes from Australia. On the left, you see the pioneers, Chris Christensen up on top at the Potts Hill Reservoir, building a grating array to observe the solar emission, and needing a lot of simultaneous spacings because it's both time variable and frequency variable. So you have to have lots of elements. It's a fairly big, but it's still quite fairly specialized instrument. And below that is Bernie Mills' Mills Cross, very like the array which we just heard about from Jocelyn. And then towards the end of this period, there is the proposal to build a big single dish. And motivated by Taffy Bowen, pretty much because he wanted to build a big single dish. He didn't actually care that much what it was used for, but it had, was originally had to be bigger than Jodrell Bank. It didn't quite be bigger than Jodrell Bank, but it was going to be the big dish, and that was the driver. And then the people in this group now had a mixture of specialists, like Bernie Mills, building specialized instruments, Joe Pawsey trying to reconcile both groups, and Bowen simply pushing ahead and very successfully building this big single dish. So I've now just picked out a few discoveries to quickly summarize the impact that some of these general purpose instruments had. Let's see, I don't need to go through this, but I've got them all here. This was the famous North Pole survey. It's not the first rotation synthesis image, but it's very close to that. And it was almost certainly the one that had huge impact. Martin Ryle and Neville then, and and Gower now. Made this image, interesting, this is back in 62. It took another 40 years before better quality low frequency images were made, so this was really quite spectacular. And it was only possible, which I'll come back to in a minute, because it used the EDSAC 2 computer, which had been was capable of doing Fourier transforms and had been developed in Cambridge. And I'll come back to that aspect later as something that enabled this. Dave Jonsi has already given you the 3C273 story, so this is a very nice example of the big dish at Parkes being used for the discovery of quasars. Of course, there was no concept there were quasars when this dish was designed, so making it a general purpose dish meant that it was possible to use it for these observations. And quite crucially, Dave mentioned, and so I'll bring that up, they quickly changed frequencies from the lower frequencies to the higher frequencies where they got better occultation records. That was a fundamental design of a general purpose instrument. Make it so that it's easy to change frequencies. I was a student of John Bolton's, and he hammered this one into me. If you build special purpose arrays with a fixed frequency, they will perhaps be restricted to doing a very narrow range of science. But by having a telescope in which you can easily change the frequency of just one receiver, you can then explore a lot more parameter space. So this is part of the concept. I might also remind you, it's not the 60s, of course, this happened, but Grote Reber built his parabolic dish because he didn't know what frequency he wanted to make these observations at. And he didn't want an array with fixed length bits of wire. He wanted something which would focus at all wavelengths, hence the parabola, and hence the discovery of non-thermal radiation. So, I'm trying to sort of set the mode feeling here that there are good reasons for doing specialized things, and there can be good reasons for doing general purpose things. Ken mentioned one of the famous early discoveries, really all nailed by Arecibo, and soon after it came online in 1965, using radar to get signals off both the surfaces of Mercury and Venus, and to confirm some early JPL results using NASA tracking stations, which of course had radar for communication. And showed that the rotation periods were completely unexpected. Here's a case which I wasn't sure whether to call this general purpose or special purpose, but in the end I think it fits in the general purpose instrument. Paul Wild and many others wanted to actually understand the nature of the non-thermal emission from the sun. It was known that emission was coming from small regions, the sunspots. It was known that it had a huge amount of frequency and time structure, but there was no spatial images that were possible, so he designed this telescope, which is the solar heliograph at Kulgura. I had to call it Kulgura because Sydney University used Narrabri for their intensity interferometer, and CSIRO and Sydney University didn't talk to each other at that particular point, so this is called Kulgura, which is a tiny radio sighting, and don't try and find it on a map. And now the site of the Australia Telescope National Facility. So, opened in the late 60s, and basically nailed almost all the outstanding problems in solar radio astronomy, in a sense so successful that the field was most of the key observations were made within that decade. Here's an example of an image of type 4 burst showing how it evolves. Each of those panels there is, I think, it was a 2 second, yeah, 2 seconds per image in both polarizations. And this is back in 1968. We didn't get this kind of dynamic spatial imaging until just in the last few years. This was really quite incredible. He used very special purpose hardware to do a special kind of Fourier transform by summing Bessel functions, which were all kept in special purpose hardware in order to do this. So you can see the polarization, and you can see these great flares, the loops of emission from the sun. This instrument was used by Bruce Lee for a lot of low-frequency extragalactic radio astronomy, so I decided it was probably okay to put it in between general and special purpose. The other thing that's happening in the 60s is technology revolution, and I often talk about the way in which the evolution of technology has really leads to almost all scientific discoveries that are made. It's quite rare that clever theoreticians, cosmologists at Cambridge actually come up with ideas which turn out to be true. It's much more common that a new instrument is discovered, a new technique comes into existence which can explore new parameter space. So this was explored by my favorite philosopher of science, De Solla Price, who published in 1963 a thing called Big Science, Small Science, in fact. And he just showed across all fields of science, most scientific advances follow laboratory experiments, a large number. A bit later, we had the wonderful study by Martin Harwitz in his Cosmic Discovery, which really included the same conclusions that De Solla Price had arrived at before. But Martin is looking just at astronomy and reaches exactly the same conclusion for astronomy. De Solla Price didn't actually look at astronomy. His examples are all from other areas of science. Martin was also quantitative. Discoveries peak soon after a new technology appears, usually within 5 years. So that's when you open up this parameter space. There's about 5 years when the specialized instruments are going to be able to come in and make a killing. And in the early stages, Martin is correct. The instruments used are often built by the observer. And Jocelyn, of course, having built the scintillation array in Cambridge, knew perhaps almost better than anybody else how to tell between something that was worth following up because it was truly unusual as compared with some instrumental error that you don't want to waste too much time on. However, I think Martin is actually biased, and if you read the study now, you would find that most discoveries are not made by the instruments that people build themselves. This was the case, but it doesn't stay that way. Things change. Two of the technology impacts then in the 60s, which I thought were pretty striking, were the way receivers were changed. The sensitivity of the amplifiers that detect the radio signals. And this had a dramatic effect, which I'll show you in the next slide, because it actually changed the balance between building arrays and building dishes. And the other huge impact is the impact of computers and digital signal processing. Here's an example of the way receivers actually made some changes. Back when Parkes was proposed, in the late 50s, there was a huge argument going on in Australia as to whether you should build arrays working at lower frequencies or build a single dish. Here's a quote from Bernie Mills, mid-50s, I forgot to look up the actual date, 55, maybe Miller, no. The dish will be confusion limited at low frequencies. So it's not going to be much use at low frequencies. And at high frequencies, you will only see thermal emission, which is very boring. I'm sorry, Jim. Anyway, this is Bernie's statement. The array will have high resolution at low frequencies, and you'll be able to map the distant universe. So he's made two fairly big errors of predicting the future. First of all, when I checked this, they didn't believe you could have a receiver with a noise temperature lower than room temperature. That concept hadn't occurred yet. So the idea that you would have these low noise receivers, which can detect sources, just wasn't discussed. The other argument they got wrong was the assumption that all radio sources had a steep spectrum. They were very pleased because synchrotron emission had just been understood as a mechanism, and so the radio galaxies were all going to be steep spectrum, so why build this thing that will only work at high frequencies? Bolton did a compromise, and that's quite important here, because he said, well, we do need the resolution of an interferometer, but why don't we have two biggish single dishes rather than a whole array? And he had already described this idea before he went to Caltech. And then when he went to Caltech, this is what he built, the two 90-foot dishes, which are the Owen Sound Radio Observatory. So he got the flexibility of being able to change frequencies and put in low-quality receivers, and he had the resolution to identify things, which is really what he wanted to do. Here's a summary I made of the evolution of receiver developments based a lot on discussion with Sandy Weinreb. And again, that 1960s period, we went from room temperature receivers down to the first cryogenically cooled receivers around 50K. So you see, getting below 50K is diminishing returns. We've got the ground radiation and the sky radiation. So even the best systems now are still only around 20K on most telescopes. So it was the 60s where the dramatic change occurred. I love, by the way, looking for exponentials, and so it doesn't fit in my talk, but I just did it a few weeks ago. I thought, oh, I'll plot those numbers on a log linear plot and see if they fit an exponential. And of course, the line was there before, but I don't see it now. Oh yeah, I see the line. As usual, it is following an exponential in time. And the other big revolution from technology was the introduction of computers. As I said, in Cambridge in particular, this had a huge impact. There were chance circumstances, the development of the digital, the idea of using a digital computer to do a Fourier transform came completely out of the crystallography group. This is not an idea of the Cambridge radio astronomers. This was pushed by the crystallographers to interpret their X-ray crystallography. And so programs were written to do Fourier transforms on these new computers. And lovely picture there of life in Cambridge in the 60s, queuing up to put your program into the computer. I don't know, was it still like that, Jocelyn?
Yeah, paper tape.
Yeah, that's what the lady there is loading, I think.
I've done mothballs to prevent moths settling by the light.
Oh, because they block the hole.
Yep.
Not because they eat a hole in it, yeah. And just for your interest, the very first Earth rotation aperture synthesis telescope based on a digital computer was the one made by Blythe, his low frequency survey, and his transform. It took 15 hours to do a 38.1D transform, and then he had to do, he did 360 of them to make an image. Lots of other technology changes are occurring. Radcliffe had written all of the explanations of the relationship between the aperture and the sky in his lecture courses at Cambridge, very clearly laid out. Jennison published his version of this. Somewhat later, we have Bracewell's copy of the same lecture notes. And Senri Weinreb, my next picture, built the first correlator, and the Cooley-Tookie algorithm also came along. So there were these big technology changes. And the success of the 1 mile telescope in mapping so many extragalactic sources was really underpinned by that computer technology. The other amazing thing is digital technology changes, and here's Sandy Weinreb's first digital correlator, invented as part of his thesis. Slide I got from Dan Wertheimer. Interesting story here. At this time, Joe Pausi, who I'll mention again in the next slide, on his first visit to NRAO after he had accepted that he would become the director of NRAO, looked at everything they were doing, and he writes a letter summarizing what NRAO is good at, and he says he met this amazing engineer, Sandy Weinreb, who has the most brilliant ideas of anybody I talked to. So he picked this technology as the real winner. Well, that brings me into this concept of user facilities, because you have a general purpose facility, then people other than the ones who built it can also use it. And in 1961, Joe Pausi had been appointed as NRAO director. And he wrote from his hospital bed, because he had already been diagnosed with cancer, which turned out to be terminal. He wrote a proposed astronomy program, which I will show you in the next slide. But I just wanted to point out that all of a sudden I am seeing for the first time this concept is that you build telescopes for a community of users. Perhaps more in CSIRO, these telescopes could be used by other astronomers, but the idea that you would actually build a national radio astronomy observatory for a community of users is a new one, which is emerging here. And I put that thing about what is a user, because I discovered astronomers, if you look at the way technology is developed in industry, we are what are called sophisticated end users. Mostly when you build things for people, dishwashers, they're not that sophisticated, so you don't get feedback on how to build a better dishwasher. But if you build the telescope and then you have astronomers use it, they actually complain and say, sure, this doesn't work properly, you can do this better. So if you're developing new technology, sophisticated end users are really useful. So astronomers have a real use, even in the commercial world. And there would be no such concept as open skies if we didn't have users. So that's interesting. By the way, tomorrow afternoon there is a focus meeting, we'll talk about open skies policy in Global Instruments. So PAWSI generated this exact list, thanks to Miller Goss, who is researching all of this. This was written, I think, from the hospital in Boston. He's summarizing what he thought the big project would be. This is his list: H2 regions and absorption at low frequencies. It's becoming actually popular again now. Nothing happened for a long time. Recognize that because of the synchrotron mechanism, magnetic fields are going to be traceable through the radio. So the idea was, let's try and detect linear polarization and maybe even Zeeman splitting. Little ticks there mean that these are things which really did happen and had a big impact. I think we will hear about that from Richard this afternoon. And Zeeman enabled by Sandy Weinreb's correlator, that was realized at the time that that would be possible. High angular resolution for solar flares, and I showed you the remarkable results from the solar heliograph, so that all happened. And counting radio sources, because in this period there was the enormous controversy as to whether the source scope counts were steep and violated Big Bang and showed there was evolution, the Ryle view, or were the source counts Euclidean, as was claimed by the Australians at that time. And there was these are the very words used here, violent disagreement. So the idea was we must build some instruments that can actually settle these arguments. So here's an example of what happened on counting sources. I've got another one of my plots of log linear plots showing that the number of sources counted, apart from a weird thing that happened in the 80s, it follows the exponential. And in yellow, you see the period of the 60s, and what happened was you have 3C, Parks, MSH, 4C, are the four dots in there. These are the names which are associated with almost all strong radio sources in the sky. We'll have one of those names. These were the first reliable source catalogs. So in fact, the 60s nailed it and made catalogs which didn't have side loads in them, which actually had real sources, and everything was resolved. Ryle's data had been wrong, but he got the right answer. It was not nearly as steep as he said, but it was steep enough to prove evolution, so another discovery from this period. But to me, what's interesting is, my God, look how much they miss. So the thing is, you can get from what you know, you can make reasonable predictions about what a new telescope will do. But today, nearly all of the things we've heard about were not on that list. The quasars, the CMB, the masers, the pulsars. So, same message that you've heard from me many times before. New telescopes are for exploring the unknown. and not for following up the things we already know. During this period, proposal was submitted to NSF. Here's the cover, volume one, of the proposal for a very, very large array. And in the text here is, again, verbatim from inside of the cover. It's why a VLA should be built. And importantly, they wanted a radio telescope which can produce a picture of a radio source with resolution and sensitivity comparable with what could be achieved with optical telescopes. So the first quasars had been discovered and were having a huge impact, the distant radio galaxies. So the idea was, let's build a telescope which can make a radio image of a quasar. So here's the telescope that they went on and built 15 years later before it was opened. A little plot here, actually prepared by some optical astronomers, showing a number of papers published versus time, and the one on the top there is the VLA. In many respects, one of the most successful ground-based telescopes at any wavelength ever built. Some of these statistics, thank you, comes from Virginia. And the ones below it are the 8-meter telescopes. But, you know, they can only observe when it's clear weather and at night, so they have huge disadvantages. But anyway, it was designed to make images of quasars. Well, how well did it do? There's Dave's 3C273 HST, fine HST image, and there's Rick Perley's VLA image. So it actually did what it was built for. Thank you.
Summary of what he saw the developments in Australian astronomy in the next 10 years. Radio astronomy was not mentioned. At the end of the meeting, Ron Bracewell got us up and he said, Sir Richard, what about radio astronomy? He said, we don't need to worry about it. It's not going to exist in 10 years.
Harry.
You sort of minimized the importance of the fast Fourier transform algorithm. It was really transformative at the time that it took making maps from the supercomputers of the age down to something that the observatory could contemplate only.
Did Barry, if I can reply, ask a question back? So as one of the architects of the VLA, you would have depended on that being the case. Do you have any hope of making it work? So, is that the case, or were you hoping that this would be discovered?
We found out about it when the design was reasonably far along, and it was a shock and a transformation, as I said.
Jocelyn, is it true that fast Fourier transform was invented or used in Cambridge and kept secret? Martin, you want the Americans to...
No, I don't think that was fairly public knowledge, but Martin...
No, this is before the fully paper was published.
I don't know, I wasn't arrived.
I don't know, but I can tell you a story which I do know to be true, which is related again. So, when I was visiting Cavendish and was shown the lovely array of people's theses, I got Peter Scheuer's thesis, which is about... five chapters, I think, on the theory of thermal radiation from H2 regions, and one chapter on the theory of synthesis telescopes. It is beautiful. It has a detailed description before Bracewell and Roberts, before there's anything else to it. And I am told by reliable sources, Martin Longer, for example, that Martin will not let him publish that chapter. On the grounds that it may be used for the competition. So sad, but I believe that part of the story is true.
Thank you. Yeah.
Just interesting to note that the rebuild of ENSAC is about half finished at the National Museum of Computing and Electronic Art in England. It's well on its way, but if you have £100,000 just to help it along, that'd be really
good. Probably more than it costs to build the beginning. It's
costing about £300,000.
No, but how much did it cost to build in the beginning? Probably much less than that.
No.
It's called inflation.
Yeah.
So it'd be really interesting to get down to, I wonder if the data still exists, to recreate one of the radio images.
They're certainly very anxious to run this machine on real data.
George?
You don't pay tapes or something around us?
Ron, don't you think that the culture of radio astronomy was influenced very much by the background people who came into it, very different from optical astronomy. The electrical engineers, pioneers of radar in the Second World War. And that had a very, very important influence, I think, on the initial, certainly up to the 60s.
Okay.